It is Thursday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump says he will accept the U.S. election result if he wins.
This is not for Donald Trump to decide. It's for the Electoral College to decide. And once the Electoral College certifies that either he or Hillary Clinton has won the presidency, that's it.
Concerns grow about civilians in Mosul as Iraqi forces battle the Islamic State, and technology gives students an innovative tool for cheating. It's all ahead. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump debated Wednesday with his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton. On Thursday, Trump said he will accept the results of the November 8th election if he wins. Mark Rozell is the dean of the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. I asked him whether Trump's position is unique among presidential candidates.
It's not only unique for a presidential nominee of a major party to say that he may not accept the legitimacy of the outcome. It's absolutely unprecedented in American presidential history. So a lot of people are very concerned about that, but I would just caution to those who worry that somehow this is going to have some long-standing effect on the American political process that this is not for Donald Trump to decide. It's for the Electoral College to decide. And once the Electoral College certifies that either he or Hillary Clinton has won the presidency, that's it. And the loser can say, I congratulate my opponent or refuse to do so and say the election was not legitimate, but the loser really doesn't have any say in the outcome. So you can see right now many major figures in the Republican Party are condemning what Mr. Trump said in the debate. And they're making it very clear that our electoral democracy stands strong and the winner is accorded legitimacy. And we unite behind the president after the election's over. That's the way things work. So I think Mr. Trump, at a certain point, will just become an angry outlier. And most people in the political system will simply ignore him at that point.
Yeah, well, because even up to this point, Trump has really clashed with a number of people in the Republican leadership.
Well, that's right. So it's been an extraordinary election year, of course. That goes without saying, but one of the things that makes it so is the fact that you have this fellow who is a non-traditional politician by any standard, never having held any public office in his life, having defeated the Republican establishment. And to be very clear, the establishment wing of the party tried to vanquish him all through the nomination process, and they failed. And Mr. Trump feels he owes them nothing. You know, here he stands as the legitimate nominee of a major political party, and yet many of the leading figures in the party have done very little to help him. Many have badmouthed him. Many have openly opposed him. And he feels that the party owed him, as the legitimate winner of the primary process, their support. So we've never seen anything like this before, quite frankly. And yes, in a normal election year, the nominee would be accorded the almost uniform support of the major figures within his or her party, and that would just be unquestioned. But with Donald Trump, it's been an entirely different dynamic this year.
Another part of the debate that got quite a lot of attention was when both candidates were discussing the subject of Russia. And Trump has been accused in the past of being favoriting, in a way, Russian President Vladimir Putin. And both candidates talk about that. But again, the idea that another country, particularly a country like Russia, which has been an adversary of the United States for quite a long time, I'm sure that would probably make some political observers and some voters concerned about any relationship between Trump and Putin or the Russians.
Well, that's right. And the fact that Mr. Trump said some complimentary things about Putin gave an issue to Hillary Clinton that she's been able to exploit in multiple ways in this election cycle. Take the debate last night. Hillary Clinton is asked a question about things that were revealed in the WikiLeaks revelations, you know, various email conversations and the like, the speeches that she gave, her private utterances being different than her public ones. These were legitimate issues to raise once they came to the public fore, but she was able to pivot and say, well, look at this. Look who made sure that this got released. It was the Russians, and they're playing with our electoral system, and Mr. Trump is endorsing them. And so it ended up taking an issue that could be hurting her presidential campaign and turning it completely around to what is Mr. Trump doing, supporting or at least providing complimentary words toward Vladimir Putin and encouraging the Russians to hack Hillary Clinton's emails or to mess with the U.S. electoral system. So really bad judgment on his part, and also just politically really stupid.
That's Mark Rozell. He's the dean of the Scar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. And I'm sure, Andrew, social media is kind of getting very excited with reaction to this debate.
Absolutely. We're hearing, you know, these phrases that came up during the debate trend on social media, things like Donald Trump calling Hillary Clinton a nasty woman, the term bad hombres when he was talking about illegal immigration. People really running with these on social media, kind of making fun of Donald Trump. There's actually been, though, a motivating factor with some of these terms, particularly the nasty woman. We're seeing some people tweet out and say, you know what, if I'm a nasty woman or I am a nasty woman, I'm going to vote on November 8th, and I'm going to go out and express my voice if you think I'm a nasty woman. So it is a motivator for women on social media. And out of that debate, we're actually seeing a kind of a viral letter today on social media from 23 years ago. And this was a letter from George H.W. Bush when he was leaving office, got voted out of office to his successor, Bill Clinton. And he says in this letter, you know, among other things, I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success is now our country's success. I am rooting hard for you. And a lot of people are using this letter to point out how divisive politics are now and how conciliatory and how well people got along back even just a couple of decades ago, and kind of longing for that time when people got along much more in politics, and using this letter as an example. Now, people are asking where this letter came from, and it was a letter to Bill Clinton, so there's a suggestion that maybe the Clinton campaign released this, or they had something to do with the release of this letter. But it is getting a lot of people worked up about how contentious this election has been, and it's getting a lot of people pining for more civility in our politics. So we'll see if we end up getting that as the election moves on. I don't think we will, but who knows. And then finally, very quickly, today is hashtag Spirit Day. It's a day to mark awareness about bullying, especially among LGBT youth. So people around the world are wearing purple to show their expression and solidarity with that. So if you see people wearing purple, that may be the reason why.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Russia extends a humanitarian pause in Aleppo, Syria. The Philippines announces a separation from the U.S. during the visit of its president to China. Azerbaijan arrests political activists and critics of the government, and the state of Georgia executes a man convicted of killing a police officer. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A defibrillator is a device used to restore the normal operation of a heart after a life-threatening cardiac episode such as dysrhythmias and ventricular fibrillation. The machine delivers a powerful electric shock that stops the heart and allows it to reset itself to function normally again. While defibrillation has a long history of saving lives, it can be extremely painful, and it's possible the electric shock can damage heart tissue. After experimenting on mice, a joint team of researchers from Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. and Germany's University of Bonn have successfully demonstrated a system that uses gentle beams of light instead of electric shocks to revive patients with deadly heart rhythm disorders. To see if their system called optogenetic defibrillation can work on people, the researchers will continue their experimentation on a computer model of a human heart they created. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear how new technology can help students cheat. Iraq's Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi says the operation to retake Mosul from Islamic State is going much faster than expected. He spoke in Paris, where foreign ministers from Western and Middle Eastern nations have been meeting to discuss how to restore peace and stability once the Islamic State group is ousted from Mosul. Well, Iraqi government and Kurdish Peshmerga forces say they're within 25 kilometers of Mosul. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the closer the Iraqi and coalition forces get to the city, the more difficult the fighting is likely to become and the more dangerous for the millions of civilians trapped in the city.
يقول الله سبحانه وتعالى الذين قال لهم الناس.
Islamic State released a propaganda video Wednesday purporting to show its fighters defiantly patrolling the streets of Mosul. An unidentified militant addresses the camera, warning that the United States will be defeated in Iraq. Despite the rhetoric, Islamic State fighters are rapidly losing ground. Backed by coalition artillery and airstrikes, Iraqi and Kurdish Peshmerga forces say they are ahead of schedule in their mission to retake Mosul. Iraqi Army spokesman Brigadier Yahya Rasul described the conditions they are facing. He said there have been more than 20 suicide cars trying to target army vehicles during the advance, but they were all destroyed. More than 100 US troops are embedded with Iraqi and Peshmerga forces behind the front lines. International coalition jets are targeting Islamic State positions in Mosul. Local residents have told of reports of fighters forcing civilians into buildings they believe are likely to be targeted. Visiting fellow Afzal Ashraf of the University of Nottingham Center for Conflict, Security and Terrorism says the population faces grave danger.
There is always the very strong possibility that this terror group Daesh will use them physically as human shields. So there are, I'm afraid, some very difficult days ahead for the population.
As the battle approaches the center of Mosul, Ashraf says the fighting is likely to get much more difficult.
We'll get into the urban warfare type of environment, which again involves suicide bombers, but here in narrow streets, it's very difficult for the coalition forces to avoid them. Right now, there'll be a great deal of surveillance to detect any possible areas where bombs have been planted.
1.5 million civilians are thought to be living in Mosul. Many are expected to flee, presenting an opportunity for Islamic State fighters to escape, says Ashraf.
Daesh will use the human exodus. They will use other means of disguising themselves, and I believe they've already begun to leave the city.
That could allow Islamic State fighters in Mosul to regroup in Syria, neighbouring countries, or Europe. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Alan MacDonald is Middle East regional spokesperson for the British-based organization Save the Children. Speaking from Erbil, Iraq, he tells me about his organization's concerns surrounding the civilians in Mosul.
Our main concern is the civilians inside Mosul. Mosul is the city, the vast majority of people are civilians. We think there are about 500,000 or 600,000 children inside the city, and these families are completely trapped. They know that the offensive is getting closer and the fighting is going to escalate, but there's no way out of the city. So they really face an impossible choice of either staying put and potentially being caught up in the crossfire and the bombing, or trying to flee but having to run a gauntlet of snipers and landmines and booby traps that have been planted around the city. So whatever they choose, whether it's to stay or go, they face extreme danger.
What about efforts to flee to go to a Syrian refugee camp?
In the past few weeks, ahead of the offensive, and in the past couple of days, we've seen more people crossing into Syria from Iraq. So these are people mostly from villages around Mosul who managed to flee somehow and get across the border, but they're living now in or taking shelter now in a extremely basic camp just across the border, where there's very little clean water, there's very little sanitation. There's a big fear that as the camp gets more overcrowded, as more people keep arriving, that conditions are going to keep getting worse. And the UN, so far we've seen a few thousand cross the border into Syria, but the UN is expecting that anything up to 100,000 might cross in the coming weeks as the offensive escalates. So this is going to become a much, much bigger crisis there.
So this sounds like a terribly desperate situation. I guess people within the city can't get out. Those who are outside are trying to flee into Syria, which of course has its own problems, and into a camp that's not able to really help or, you know, take care of the amount of people coming in.
That's right. The camps are very, very stretched. There's going to be enormous pressure on them when people start arriving in large numbers. At the moment, we're just seeing a few thousand moving from around Mosul, but we're expecting anything up to a million, or certainly hundreds of thousands of people who might flee once the offensive gets closer to the city in the next few weeks. And at the moment, there's only camps prepared for about 80,000 people, which is obviously a tiny amount of the people who might need help. Aid agencies have been pre-positioning supplies like food and water and so on to help people when they arrive. But at the moment, the UN's emergency appeal for the Mosul crisis is still only about half funded. So there are enormous gaps given the scale of the crisis that we're likely to see.
That's Alan McDonald. He's a spokesman for Save the Children. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Cheating on exams is not new. What is new is how students are doing it. No more writing answers in their hand or a slap on the wrist if they're caught. Smart technology has transformed cheating, and stopping it has become a global challenge. And as Faiza El-Masri tells us, it requires smart, comprehensive solutions. Faith Lapidus narrates.
The problem, says technology and social media expert Niall Nickel, can seem overwhelming.
Just take the cell phone or even the programmable calculators. There's so much information that could be stored in those devices. We also have things like Google Glass as well as smart contact lenses that have the ability to capture video and transmit it to a remote site, and with things like smart watches where they could now look at their wristwatch basically for the answers to a question.
Earlier this year, several Thai students were caught using that technique to cheat on entrance exams to a top medical school. Other high-tech devices that facilitate cheating include a watch that appears to display nothing, but when you put on special glasses sold with the watch, the screen becomes visible and you can see any uploaded content.
You've also have Bluetooth devices. They're using some super high-frequency ringtones on their phone that only young people could hear. In fact, if you're much over the age of 30 or 35, you can't hear it. And so they're able to answer their phone where nobody knows that they're answering the phone, and they're not talking, they're just getting the answers in their ear.
There's a reason that the kids are cheating.
Denise Pope is senior lecturer at Stanford University and co-founder of Challenge Success, an organization that works with schools and families to improve student well-being and engagement with learning. She says cheating is a symptom of a bigger problem.
It's not the kids who you would think would normally cheat. These are kids who are doing well in school, and they are still cheating because they need to keep up their grades. They feel the pressure to maintain a really high grade point average. So a lot of the kids will say there's too much work to be done and there's not enough time to do it. Some of the kids will say we have to do that because everybody's cheating, and if you don't cheat, it's actually like you're being punished for not cheating.
To combat cheating in the age of smart technology, educational institutions are coming up with innovative strategies, from banning all devices from testing rooms to screening for radio signals. But Pope says improving the learning and testing process can be more effective.
Instead of trying to chase this problem, to get out in front of it. And what I mean by that is to create assignments where it's almost impossible to cheat. And I'll give you some examples. Asking kids to turn in multiple drafts of their essays or their projects so that you know it's their own work and you can give them feedback. This is, by the way, just better teaching, not just to stop cheating, but it's a better way to teach. And, you know, when it comes to tests and assessments, it's much more difficult to cheat on what we would call constructed response assessment, where you're actually writing the response as opposed to circling or filling in bubbles, which is much, much easier to cheat. You have no idea if the kids did it on their own or if they guessed or if they copied from a neighbor.
Inviting teachers, students, and their parents to openly talk about the problem can be part of the solution. Researcher Denise Pope says engaging students and emphasizing high standards for honesty can also be crucial in preventing cheating. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And that's our show. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has responded to a series of missile attacks aimed at U.S. Navy ships sailing in international waters off the coast of Yemen. Missiles from an area in Yemen controlled by Houthi rebels were launched toward these ships on October 9th, 12th, and 15th. On October 13th, the U.S. targeted three radar sites along the coast and sent cruise missiles from the U.S. destroyer Nitze to degrade the ability of the sites to track and target ships in the future. Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook said the U.S. strikes were a matter of self-defense, a response to threats to our vessels and to freedom of navigation, which is a core U.S. national security interest.
More than 4 million barrels of oil a day pass through the Bab el-Mandeb. This narrow passage is a vital link connecting Asia and Europe. Safe navigation through the strait is vitally important to economies in the region and to global commerce.
The current military conflict in Yemen started in March 2015 when rebels from the minority Houthi community, backed by Iran, took over large swaths of territory and forced the elected president, Abed Mansour Hadi, to flee the country. At the request of President Hadi, a Saudi Arabian-led military coalition began airstrikes against Houthi positions. The U.S. has been aiding the coalition with intelligence and logistical support, but has also expressed serious concern over the loss of civilian life, including the recent airstrike on a funeral in Yemen that killed more than 140 mourners and wounded hundreds more. U.N. Special Envoy Ismail Old Sheikh Ahmed announced earlier this week a cessation of hostilities agreed by all sides, which will de-escalate tensions and lead to a resumption of negotiations that could bring an end to the fighting. At the Pentagon, Press Secretary Cook added that those who might threaten U.S. forces should recognize that we will not tolerate threats to our people. We will respond if our forces come under fire. We have taken swift action in this case, and should we see a repeat, we will be prepared to take appropriate action again at the appropriate time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/